third week of our five-week introductory course. And as we begin here, maybe waiting for more people to come in, does anyone have any questions like to ask, or maybe someone would like to report something about their meditation this last week? That anything kind of use the time a little more informally. Maybe what you should all know is that it's said that you create a lot of very good karma for yourself if you ask questions. Please.
It's not exactly a question, but I wouldn't mind if you talked just a little bit about effort.
Effort. That's a good topic, and but maybe you could give me a little bit of a more of a context for why it interests you.
I guess the effort I'm talking about is both effort within sitting, because of sleeping is still always nicer thing, or falling asleep, and kind of bad about asking because I know it's my own effort that I need to work on. But effort to actually see every day.
So effort is a very important element of any meditation practice, any spiritual practice at all. And effort can mean engagement. It can mean as simple as simply doing it. And sometimes it's a big challenge just to do it, like a meditation practice, to do it every day in a consistent way. To be persistent about it is very important. And for that, it helps if you spend some time looking at your intention. And as you probably heard me say here many times before, I think it's more significant for a person to every day spend some time reflecting on what their deepest intention is for themselves, for their lives, than it is to meditate every day. And I think it's important to meditate every day. But it's more important to reflect on your heart's deepest wish, your deepest intention. And then if you have some sense of that, or some, it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to seem profound, but the most profound one that's accessible to you. And then you see, you know, what's the connection between that and meditation practice? And if you can find some connection, then often then the enthusiasm and inspiration to meditate every day becomes a lot easier. It becomes a matter of kind of straightening out the priorities. It's very easy in a society like ours to have our priorities a little bit skewed. We have a tremendous amount of pressure coming from many different directions for us to do all kinds of things which maybe are not even to our best interest. And so to spend some time reflecting about our deepest intentions sometimes can straighten that out and looking at our priorities. Sometimes it's helpful to look at if there is a lot of inspiration but the person still does not maintain a regular practice, keeps, you know, wanting to do it but then doesn't. It's helpful to look at the nature of if there's resistance. Sometimes there's resistance because meditation practice isn't always, you know, bliss and light and ease. Sometimes it has its challenges. For example, part of what mindfulness meditation involves is being quite honest about who you are. And self-honesty, self-understanding is sometimes not good news. And that's considered to be an important part of the practice, is that self-discovery process. And so some people have some resistance because of that. Sometimes there's some uncomfortable aspect of meditation, like sleepiness or something, which is uncomfortable. And so the resistance comes out of not being willing to be present for the discomfort or for whatever. So to look at the resistance is helpful sometimes in effort. In the doing of the practice, once you get to the cushion, you're actually doing the meditation practice. Tuning into effort is still very important because there can be too little or too much, and we have to kind of find right balance. If it's too much, then we tend to get restrained, for example, and become goal-oriented. And if we're too complacent, then we tend to fall asleep, or, you know, we just kind of drift along, kind of without any really any benefits of meditation. The mind wanders off in its fantasy. So there has to be a balance between, you know, between too much and too little, and it's a little bit hard sometimes to find that balance. And the way we find it is not by being someone pointing out to you what the balance looks like, but rather by trial and error. You find your own way by going a little bit too far in one direction, saying, "Oh, that's not quite, that's too much," and then pulling back, and that's too little. So part of a meditation practice, which I wasn't going to talk about during the intro course, but is also kind of stepping back in a sense and monitoring the what's happening, how you're practicing, how you're engaged in the practice itself, and trying to moderate or adjust the volume of the effort so it just seems right given where you're at. Sometimes when the mind is really wild and just, you know, it's really hard to even be present for anything, the mind just, sometimes it's appropriate to have like a warrior's effort, just say, "I'm going to stand, I'm going to sit down here, I'm going to really clench my teeth and just really be present for the breath and really kind of be really firm and like a warrior." And other times that effort is just a disaster, and especially people tend to over effort anyway. And so then sometimes you're very gentle, receptive, allowing approach is appropriate. So it's the kind of effort we bring is actually a very key aspect of meditation practice. And probably for your whole meditation career, you'll be learning how to adjust the volume on effort and how to work with it. So we're taking questions.
Yeah, I have one, Gil.
Please.
Can you just remember out of curiosity how long that took to sort of find that sort of balance? Mm-hmm. I mean, I really feel I struggled, you know, just at the beginning here, you know, to really find any sort of calmness or peace or anything that comes. And I try not to be judgmental about it. I just know it's the argument. But just remember out of curiosity, I was wondering if how long it took to start feeling like being able to fine tune and being present for a period of time.
It still continues. It isn't. So it's not something that ever stops, because our life is not static. You know, it's constantly changing, and all kinds of input from the environment, and our life changes. And so, the appropriate efforts that's required in different meditation sessions varies. So, it's a matter of fine tuning each session. And after a while, you learn to get to develop the skill. You find the knob, for example, and which is for a long time you don't even know you have one. And so, but then once you find it, you know, take some finding, you know, fine tuning, you know, something that continues. And even for me to this day, it's not a matter of just sitting down and knowing exactly what the volume should be, but rather sometimes, you know, I make some effort and that seems that's too much or that's too little, and then I adjust it based on kind of trial and error. If the question is how long it took before I had some benefits from meditation, just in general, in terms of developing some calm, some ability to be present, I would say that I had benefits pretty quickly, but they were, compared to where I am now, they were pretty modest. But given where I was at my time I started meditating, they felt very significant, because I was, you know, filled with conflict and stress and all kinds of things, and so benefits can be immediate. Some people it takes a while. To measure the benefits of meditation. Some people see benefits right away, very dramatically in their meditation. Some people see it; they don't see any benefit in meditation itself. They sit, and their mind seems always to be somewhat monkey-like. Your mind has a mind of its own, kind of thing. However, they find that by doing it every day, even though nothing seems to happen in their meditation, it seems to improve their daily life quite a bit. There's more presence, more calm in their daily life. So it's important not to be too narrow in what we're looking for in terms of the benefits or how we measure it. Sometimes it's better to wait. If you're new to meditation, if you have the patience and the inspiration to continue, it's best to wait 3-4 months. Before you really evaluate the benefits, you know, that you've gotten. And then it's also very interesting, if you've meditated on a daily basis for 3-4 months, then it's also interesting to stop meditating for a week and see what the difference is, because some of the benefits sneak up on you, and they kind of come up gradually, slowly. You're a little bit more calm, more settled, more clear, more present for things, but it's kind of happened so slowly you don't necessarily see it, you take it for granted. But then if you stop for a week, And then you say, oh, wow, I didn't realize, you know, how much it lubricated and helped my daily life. And then you can kind of see the benefits much more clearly. So if you have the patience for it, then I'd suggest wait 3-4 months before you evaluate. In that the meditation practice is part of a spiritual practice, many people who do spiritual practice will find that what's happening at a spiritual level, the significant changes that's going on in the person, are often not so clear while you're going through something. At the moment that it's occurring, it's only in retrospectively that we realize what happened. I've had things that I've seen, it's only 2 or 3 or 4 years later that I realize, wow, I didn't know that that's what was going on for me in my meditation life. I thought I was developing concentration. And really what was happening was I was developing compassion because I couldn't get concentrated. and that development of compassion was profound, the effect it had on me. So I don't know. So it's a little bit treacherous to measure the benefits of meditation, but you can do it. But I suggest you wait and do it over the long term and not over, for example, each meditation. You know, if you're new to meditation and you sit for 5 minutes, you look at your watch and say, well, you know, how far have I gotten? Which some people do, you know. So, I mean, I've sat down and watched 3 breaths and wondered, you know, have I gotten there yet? You know, it's best just to kind of have a long-term view. And that's helpful because it just helps us to relax. And the more relaxed we are, the easier it is for meditation to proceed. Please.
Question about images and talk about other spiritual practices and whether Buddhist images or if you've got other traditions that you're part of, uses and disuses or benefits or non-benefits of involving images.
Oh, I see. It's a little bit different than the kind of the purpose of the intro class, but I'll try to address it kind of very briefly. To use external images, like paintings of Buddhas or different things, or statues, is used for some Buddhists for a number of different reasons. One reason is inspirational. If a picture of a painting or a statue of the Buddha sitting in meditation is inspiring for you, to remind you of, to be present, to remind you of, you know, to meditate, then it can be very effective. And many people just use it as a reminder of some values that they hold very important. It's very easy to forget our deeper values in the course of normal life. And to have some reminders is very helpful. Some people will use it as objects of devotion. And, we don't talk, especially in intro class at all, about the value of devotion. But most spiritual practices, devotion is an aspect. And it's part of the development of faith, which in most spiritual practices is important. And so one of the ways people develop faith is through devotion towards images. Again, the images represent something which speaks very deeply to someone. And as Suzuki Roshi said, when you bow to a Buddha statue, you're really bowing to yourself. So the images are reflecting back some qualities that you have. And images are also used sometimes in Buddhism as meditation objects, where people will keep their eyes open and look at an image or look at a painting and kind of hold it in the mind's eye so much, kind of see it, and kind of like so much that you kind of develop, you know, like an after image. You know, if you look at some light or something, you turn away and it's still there. So you kind of do that. You're kind of freezing the image in your mind or holding the image in your mind so well that when you close your eyes, you can hold in your imagination, you can visualize in your mind that image. And then people will develop concentration on that visualization. And that's just a way of developing very strong concentration. However, when we do mindfulness meditation, vipassana, we don't use visualizations for any purpose. In fact, you're actually discouraged from visualizing. And that some people think with images rather than with thoughts. Those people are also taught that it's fine to do that, but don't get involved with those images. Because any kind of thought, whether it's imagery or whether it's words, tends to keep us separate from our direct experience. And what we're trying to do is to really be present for our direct experience as it is, not through mediated through thoughts. One of the common ways that people sometimes visualize to help their meditation is to visualize their breath. And sometimes people can stay very present by visualizing the breath. But again, you're a little bit removed then from the breath itself, the sensations of breathing. We want to connect directly to the sensations. Okay, so now we're warmed up. So let's start with a meditation. Take a comfortable, alert posture, letting your spine be a little bit more upright and alert than maybe is normal. So don't be tense about it. And gently close your eyes. From a purist point of view, there's no need to prepare oneself to be mindful. You can just jump right in and be attentive to what's happening right now. And you might begin this sitting with simply, directly, immediately becoming aware of the mood, the emotional state in which you're sitting in. It's said in Buddhism that every moment that we're alive, we sit with some mood or emotional state. It may be very subtle. You might be calm, anxious, happy, sad. Become aware of the mood or the emotional state, mental state you're sitting in right now. And just to be aware of it, allowing it to be there, kind of being curious, as if you've never really experienced this before. You experience it now for the first time. How would you be aware of it? What aspects of it? How does it feel in your body? Where do you feel it in your body? How are you relating to this mood or emotional state? Is there commentary about it? Is there judgment about it? Can you allow it to be there very simply, as if it has permission to be there? What happens to it as you're present for it? Sometimes it's helpful at the beginning of meditation to become aware of your mood. Because if you're aware of what it is, perhaps it's less likely to color or filter how you perceive your meditative experience. Generally, in the beginning of meditation, it's helpful to take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Breathing deep into your body. And then as you exhale, relaxing, letting go of your muscles in your body, keeping the spine erect but letting go of everything else. Letting go into the depths of your body. And then letting your breath return to normal. It can be helpful to also go through your body at the beginning of a sitting, maybe in a systematic way, to see if there's any obvious places you can let go of tension, or even just soften a little bit around the tension, starting with the forehead. The eyes, letting the eyes be soft in their sockets. Resting. Your jaws. And then for the next two or three out-breaths as you exhale, soften your shoulders, your shoulder blades. And it's helpful if you can keep your belly soft and relaxed, letting the belly hang forward. And then becoming aware of the breathing, how your body experiences the breathing. Without straining with the breath in any way, letting the breath be relaxed as possible. Become aware of the fullness of breathing as you breathe into your torso and down into your belly. The rib cage, the back rib cage, how they move and fill as you breathe in. Be aware of how when you exhale, there's a kind of release or letting go of the pressure, the tautness that's built up as you breathe in. Sometimes when you focus a camera on an object you're going to take a picture of, you can make the object very clear and all the things around the object, the distance or in front of it, are still in the viewfinder, but they become kind of fuzzy, out of focus. Let the focus of your attention be your breathing. You don't need to exclude other things from your awareness. Just let them recede into the background. Staying present gently, carefully, for the alternating rhythms of breathing. Each time you exhale, letting go of whatever thoughts and concerns that have arisen. Each time you exhale, remembering to let go of whatever thoughts and concerns that have arisen. Doesn't matter how many times your mind wanders off. It just matters that you come back again to your breathing. In a sense, letting yourself rest in the sensations of breathing. Every time you let go, every time you breathe out, let go of whatever thoughts and concerns that have arisen. There's nothing you need to think about when you meditate. The full focus of attention can be resting in each in-breath and each out-breath. The more fully you give yourself over to your breathing, the less attention or energy of attention are you giving to other thoughts and concerns. And if other thoughts and concerns are not being fed by your attention, they tend to relax and fall away. The more you can give yourself to the breathing, the more we let go of those things which cause stress and anxiety. And now, as we come to the end of the meditation, let go of your breathing. And again, see if you can notice what is the predominant mood or emotional state which is present right now. It could be a very subtle one, it could be in the background, it could be a very strong one. But what's the predominant mood or emotional state for you as you sit here? See if you can bring an allowing awareness to that, to its presence. Maybe you're calm, at ease, in a very small, subtle way. Maybe you're anxious. Content, frustrated. And then explore this emotional state, this mood. Is there some place in your body where you feel it most clearly? Perhaps the torso, or the face, the hands, stomach. All emotional states are manifested someplace in the body. besides being aware of your emotions, investigating them, are there any other forms of relationships that you have toward them? Are you judging them or commenting on them? If it's easy enough, can you just let go and be present for them in a very simple way, as if they have the right to be there, and all you need to do is to be present and aware of them there? If an emotion disappears as you're watching it, then see if something else replaces it. If it gets stronger as you watch it, then just let it get stronger and continue to be present for it. As a way of acknowledging its presence, you can very subtly whisper in the mind, name the emotional state or the mood. And then letting go of the emotion, or letting go of it, paying attention to it. Come back again a couple of more times with your breathing. Maybe breathing a little more deeply than usual. Letting go as you breathe out. So the basic idea of mindfulness meditation is to be mindful of whatever it is that arises for you as you meditate, to be mindful of what your present experience is. In that many people spend their time lost in the past or in the future in fantasy, it can be quite a transformative undertaking to simply train yourself to start coming back and being present for your experience as you're having it. And then to train yourself to stay present, to let there be some continuity of attention in the present moment, so we can see the present moment much more carefully, not just simply check it off or notice it in passing, but really begin investigating and seeing it clearly, is a very important part of mindfulness practice. One of the things that makes mindfulness practice sacred, a sacred practice, at least in its Buddhist context, is that nothing's excluded from mindfulness, from awareness. If there is an inside and outside, or if there are some things which are considered to be inappropriate or wrong for awareness, something which we want to deny or hold off or shut out from our attention, then we have separated ourselves from the sacred realm of Buddhism. A sacred realm of Buddhism arises when there's no outside, there's no exclusion, but everything is allowed to occur within the field of awareness. It doesn't mean that we allow everything to occur in the physical world, but it means we allow everything to occur in awareness without any barriers to it in awareness. What we do once we're aware of it, that's hopefully a matter of our wise choices. But allowing it to, including everything within awareness, means that awareness doesn't contract, doesn't resist what's occurring, but we allow everything in. So in mindfulness meditation, we use the breath as a very important foundation, anchor, for keeping us in the present moment. However, when something else becomes predominant, then we let go of the breath and we bring our attention to that other thing which has come into our awareness. If we held on to the breath really tightly and refused to pay attention to other things, then we've kind of shut off ourselves from that which is sacred, from that all-inclusive nature of awareness. So part of a mindfulness training is learning how to let attention move to different experiences we're having as we're having them, and let our awareness be present for them in a useful way, in a way that's meditative. And a meditative awareness is one that is non-reactive. It doesn't resist or hold on to, just allows it to be there without needing it to be any different. In normal life, we want things to be different a lot, and partly we do meditation so we can make some difference in our lives. But in the moment-to-moment doing a meditation, you have to let go of all concerns of trying to make anything happen, and then just reside in this non-reactive awareness, just allowing things to be. Training yourself to bring more careful attention and more allowing awareness to what's happening right now. In that emotions are an important part of our life, and emotions can come up quite predominantly, then they become the focus of the meditative awareness when they're predominant. If emotions are subtle and in the background of attention, then we can just leave them there and keep focusing on the breath. But when the emotions come into the foreground of attention, then we take them up as the object of meditation. Now, I think there are people in California that have manifestos of belief systems around their emotions, and they're willing to, you know, fight about their beliefs about how you're supposed to relate to your emotions. And we come to our emotions with a lot of opinions, a lot of ideas, a lot of history, and a lot of memories of how it was in the past. And so we often don't have the experience of being uncomplicated with our emotions. We have an anger, and it ties into all the other angers we've had before. It ties into our justification of being angry or embarrassment about being angry. And we don't just, you know, so it, very quickly we get involved in it. The art of mindfulness meditation is to let your emotion be there, 100%. No inhibitions, no idea that it shouldn't be there, no repression, no suppression, no denial of it. At the same time, not indulging in it, not acting on it, not getting involved in it, not feeding it, not giving it expression. And it's that balance between these two that where mindfulness practice resides, and just allowing it to be there. So anger can arise, and there's nothing wrong from the point of view of meditation for anger to arise. The important thing we're looking for is this all-inclusive awareness that can include that also. So the anger arises. However, we might feel, you know, justified in our anger, and we feel it's really important to plot how to get back at that person who did that thing to you. And so, you know, and we start rehearsing the story of what that person did, and you can be sitting quite serenely and happily and calmly, and then remember what someone did yesterday, And then start thinking about that and rehearsing it. And before you know it, you're in flame with anger. Because you've gotten involved in it, you've gotten engaged in the story and in the anger and all that. Or you're sitting here and you get angry and you feel embarrassed for being angry. You're at a meditation class. You shouldn't be angry in a meditation class, you know. How foolish can I be? I hope no one notices. And I better kind of, you know, put a smile on my face. We've gotten involved in it. This time we're kind of trying to deny it or hide it or something. The point of the practice is not to hide anything, not to turn away from anything, but to allow it to be there, but not to push it, certainly not to push it away or deny it or to try to stop it. Simply not be involved in all the story making or all the justifications or all the condemning or all the kind of fueling it that can exist. So from the point of view of an emotion, mindfulness practice feels very freeing. From the point of view of our ego, sometimes it can feel very limiting because we would like to do things with our emotions because they emotions relate often to our sense of identity. And so as it relates to our identity, we want to either get rid of it or hold on to it or do something with it. But from the point of view of the emotion itself, it's very freeing, the practice, hopefully. Just allow it to course through you. Some people have grown up with the notions that certain emotions are inappropriate and you better not have them. In meditation, there's no such need for that kind of idea. It's maybe the one place in life where it's considered completely safe, completely appropriate, to just let your emotions course through you as they wish. You have unconditional permission to have an emotion when you meditate. And then what you learn to do as you allow it to be there is you learn how to disengage from it or how to not engage in it, not to jump into it and get involved in it. And in that, many of us have this, you know, huge philosophy of how what we believe emotions are about and what we need to do about them. Sometimes it can be very challenging to hear these kinds of practice because it goes against the normal ideas of what we think we need to do. And it's a fascinating thing to do is to ride out an emotion. And the stronger the emotion, the more fun it is to do this. So you have some very strong emotion that arises. Many of us will act on it in some way or other. And sometimes the stronger it is, the more compelling the impulse is to do something. But it's very significant to just sit there and be mindful of it. Don't repress it in any kind of mean, but just kind of open up the floodgates in the body and let it kind of course through you, but without moving. Sitting still in meditation, let it just come through. And what you'll see is that it might build the pressure to do something, and then the pressure will break. The wave will kind of collapse. And on the other side of it, there's a lot of calm and peace. And it's very empowering to do that. I've known people who've been addicted to cigarettes, have used this for their desire to smoke. As they ride out the desire, they feel the desire coming. And it's always, it feels so necessary. This desire needs to be fulfilled right now or else. You know, it has a tremendous authority to it. But you're committed to riding it out, so you let it be there, but you don't act on it. So you disengage yourself from acting on the emotion. And then the emotion will get strong, the desire will get strong, and then it'll break. And then within a few minutes, everything is, you know, come back to calm and peace again, or some semblance of that. And that can be very empowering to realize that you don't have to be the slave to a desire. You can have the power to ride it out. I've known people who, you know, dealt with their cigarettes, for example, or alcohol, who found this kind of empowerment very, very helpful. The word emotion comes from Latin, and the motion of emotion means to move. The E means out in Latin, so it means to move out. And what's nice about the word emotion then is that it holds within it the idea of moving, of motion, of something that's in process. And all our emotions are in process, are moving through us, unless we freeze them, unless we hold. And much of our suffering in life can arise from frozen emotions. For example, resentment is frozen anger. So when we freeze things, we have gotten involved. We're holding on to it. Emotions don't freeze on their own. They freeze because we kind of resist them or hold on to them or do something. So in allowing an emotion to be and giving permission to be there, what happens is the emotion gets a chance to begin moving again. And sometimes it moves on out. Sometimes it just kind of dissolves by itself. Sometimes it's the movement it takes has become stronger. And then the art of meditation is just learn how to sit there with patience as the emotion gets stronger and just move through you. And it's like sometimes you're going to feel like you're sitting on the rodeo, you know, and just, you know, it can be kind of wild. You sit there and let it be wild. And sometimes an emotion can move and transform itself into another emotion. Sometimes it's a more pleasant one, and sometimes it's a more unpleasant one. It's not your business what direction it goes. Your business is, can you be present for what's going on? But the fallback in meditation is always, can you be present for what's going on? Not that something particular has to happen or needs to go the way you want it to go. So an important part of human life is our emotional life. In the practice of mindfulness, we don't give it any special value, our emotions, as you find sometimes among some people who believe emotions are the be-all and end-all of their life. We don't give them any special importance, but we also don't ignore them in any kind of way. They're an important part of life. And when an emotion becomes predominant in our meditation, then it becomes the complete focus of our attention. We bring our full awareness and feel it, sense it. Joy, anger, happiness, despair, depression, frustration, delight, you know, whatever it might be. We just bring ourselves to feel it. And as we feel it, we try to feel it as a physical event. All emotions are somehow manifested in our body. You know, if you get angry, your stomach might get tight. If you get afraid, maybe your shoulders kind of tighten up. If you're happy, perhaps you feel relaxation in your stomach or you feel kind of warmth in your cheeks. There's often a physical component part of an emotion. And it's very helpful in meditation to bring your attention to feel how it is physically, energetically in your body. Because for one reason is that the body part of an emotion is not a story. It's just a physical event. And so you can connect yourself to emotion, allow it to be there, and not so easily get pulled into the story connected to that emotion. Because as soon as you get caught up in the story, then you've gotten yourself engaged. And in meditation, story making has no value. There's no thinking or analyzing or remembering or planning that has really any role while you're meditating. You'll find much greater depths of peace, much greater depth of joy, much greater depths of insight and self-understanding if you learn how to disengage yourself to all the story-making that the mind does, so you can drop deeper and deeper into your heart and into your mind. So when emotions become predominant, the practice is to let go of the breath and recognize the emotion that's going on. Recognizing sometimes, for some people, is a huge step towards being free of it. For me, I remember it was very hard for me to see my own anger for many years when I was young. I had a self-image of someone who was not angry. And so when I was angry, I couldn't see my own anger. And it was a huge deal just simply to learn to recognize that I was angry when I was angry. Another aspect, very important part of the mindfulness of emotions, is to learn how to accept it. And accepting here means allowing it to be there. That it's okay for it to be there. It doesn't have to be any other way. No matter how great the grief, how great the anger, the despair, the depression, it's okay for it to be there. Same thing with beautiful emotions. Joy, it's okay for joy to be there. I know some people from certain religious backgrounds can sometimes feel that it's inappropriate or wrong or sinful to feel joy or delight or pleasure in meditation, because somehow that's related to something that they has a negative connotations from their upbringing. It's all okay from the point of view of meditation. So part of the training in meditation is to learn how to accept or to allow what's occurring. It's not easy to do that, especially with emotions. So you have to remember, it's part of the training is to learn how to do that. You know, so partly that involves learning how we don't accept it, how we don't allow it, how we engage in it. Learn to see that, and learning slowly to let go and disengage and be more relaxed about it being there. It's very helpful with emotions to name them in meditation. Very quietly, very small whisper in the mind, just name the emotion while it's present. It's kind of like using your thinking to stay present to what's happening, rather than letting your thoughts be idle about something completely unrelated. But also, when you name an emotion, it kind of works like the fairy tales, where if you name the dragon loses its power. And the power that the emotion loses is not the power inherent in the emotion, but the power that comes from you by feeding, when you feed the emotion by identifying with it, by getting engaged with it. Our emotional life continues through time. Not our emotional life, but certain emotions will continue frozen through time or constant through time, not because they've just, that's their nature, because we're feeding it constantly. If we weren't constantly feeding an emotion, it would dissolve very quickly. So the naming, the power that the emotion loses when you name it, is the power of identification. Because when you name it, you're not so identified with it. You're kind of, in a sense, stepping outside of its sphere and observing it from outside. Now, this is what's going on. And the last thing with emotions that's helpful is to begin investigating it in the body. Investigating what it feels like. Exactly where is it? Exactly where is that fear in your body? Can you pinpoint it? Can you find exactly where in the pit of your stomach you feel the anger or whatever? And then kind of allow it to be there. Kind of find out where it is, and then let the body hold it. Let the body be the container of the emotion. If you have very powerful emotions, you might experiment one day with, best you can, dropping out of the story of the emotion, and then letting it kind of, let the body be the holder, the container for the emotion. Let the energetics of the emotion, the feelings, the sensations of the emotion, course through your body in whatever way they want. And what you'll find is that very challenging emotions can feel a lot more comfortable and safer to have if you're holding it within the container of the body. If you try to hold it with your mind that tries to figure it out, you can just get tighter and tighter and more and more stressed by it. But if you hold it in your body, it tends to dissipate the tension and the stress related to it, and it's a lot easier to handle. So the investigation of emotions is an important element of practice, investigating in the body, but also investigating a little bit. This is a little bit difficult to say, but investigating why it arises, or what triggers it to arise. In the course of a normal day, there's a kaleidoscope of emotions that pass through a person. And that's normal. They have a wide range of emotions coming through. But as you start becoming more mindful of that kaleidoscope, of that range of things coming through, you might slowly begin becoming attentive to what happens just before the emotion has arisen. And you might see what has triggered the emotion. And if you can see what has triggered it, sometimes there's a lot of freedom that can be found at that moment, where it doesn't have to move into the emotion, or it can move into the emotion in a different way, or you don't take the emotion quite as seriously, or you kind of have some perspective on it. One example which I often give is, some years ago when I first moved up where I live now, up on Skyline Boulevard, which is up in the mountains here, I would drive home at night and the people's high beams would be on occasionally. And I would get angry. How could they be shining their high beams on me and blinding me? So this happened often enough that I got angry. So I thought, I better bring my attention to this. So every time I got angry, I'd look at that and feel it and sense it. And I just knew that I was angry. And then, because I kept looking and kept having a habit of this exploration, one day I noticed that in a flash, just before I got angry, I was afraid. And that it was the fear which triggered the anger. And as soon as I was able to recognize that moment of fear, those high beams coming my way, then from then on I've been able to stop it at fear. Now I can recognize the fear, the concern, the caution, and I'll do what's appropriate. But it doesn't flow into anger because I've kind of seen where the trigger is. Sometimes the trigger is our self-image. Some emotions arise because some event has occurred that relates to our self-image. And to see how the self-image triggers the emotion is very, very significant. Certain emotions, it kind of takes their enchantment away from them. If we use the example of being angry, if your self-image is tied up with the kind of car you have, say you have some wonderful Maserati out in the parking lot here at the meditation center, and some very mindful meditator pulls out of the driveway and bangs the door of your wonderful Maserati, and you're furious. How could they have done that? But part of the strength of the fury is not because of, you know, how much you love that car, but you know that you have to take it down to the shop. And whenever you take it to the shop, they give you a beat-up old Volkswagen Bug to drive for a couple of days. And it's very embarrassing to show up in a Volkswagen Bug, especially if it's beat up, you know, to all your high-status friends. And really why you're angry is not because of the dent, but because your self-image is going to be seriously challenged. You have a self-image handicap, kind of. So you need to have that extra kind of car. So to part of the investigation of emotions is slowly become aware of what triggers the emotion to arise. And if we can see what triggers it, then perhaps we can leave the trigger alone, or we don't buy into the trigger. And there can be a tremendous amount of freedom about how we can live our lives, and the choices about our emotions can arise with that kind of insight. So I don't know if I said that well enough, but hopefully you understand. Any questions? Please.
In meditation, when you experience emotion of sadness and you feel like crying.
Oh, yes.
So if you actually do the crying, is that getting it without necessarily getting into the story, but more having the experience of the feeling?
Yeah. Crying is a form of release. And you don't have to do anything. You don't have to be involved in the sadness for the tears to come. Oftentimes it's the resistance to it, which is the doing. And if you let go of the doing, of the engagement of resistance, then it'll just flow freely. Meditation is considered to be a wonderful place to cry. So you should all feel free to cry if that comes up. It just opens the heart of the person next to you, and that's nice. However, there's a difference between sitting here still. It's really powerful to have the practice of sitting still in meditation. You're not going to move. And then letting whatever's going to happen, happen freely. Because as soon as you move, there's a tendency that we get involved and engaged. So if you're sitting here quietly and crying, you know, so your tears are flowing, you know, and, you know, you're getting a rash because it's drying, and then it's, you know, and whatever, and you're, you know, it's, you know, it can be a mess. But, you know, you're sitting there. That's fine. But there's a big difference between that and going, you know, then we've gotten involved. You might want to do that. But then in meditation, we just sit there and we feel the impulse to want to go, oh, poor me. And you feel that impulse really carefully and allow that impulse to be there. But you don't act on it. And that is really great. Is this making some sense? Please.
I realize that in my work, which is quite challenging. It doesn't take up all my brain. So my brain's doing this challenging job, but it has this other compartment over here that's planning dinner and driving home. But I'm doing two things simultaneously. And I see when I'm meditating, my brain likes to flip into that.
Yes.
So I'm watching a movie over here, and I'm watching my breathing over here. So I'm still doing two compartments.
Yeah, you're lucky it's only two. The habits by which we live our life follow us along, stay with us. The normal ways in which we live our life become habits. And certainly the way we use our mind can become a habit, which then gets in the way. And this is not exactly what you brought up, but for example, if a person spends a lot of time with desiring things, wanting things, and even going after things and trying to get things all the time, that sets up a habit formation, a habit energy in the mind of wanting and desiring. It's sometimes very hard to turn that off. And so you might have all the things you want in the world, and you sit down to meditate, and, oh, I want. It's still operating. You don't really need anything, but that's the habit of desire that's there. Or if a person's always angry or sarcastic or always critical or judgmental, you can't just simply turn that off when you sit to meditate. The momentum of that habit is still there. And part of meditation is learning how to be gracious and allowing of the momentum that's there. And not to judge it on top of, judge it or criticize it, but learn how to slowly let it unwind as you're present for it. So if your mind does two things at once in meditation, what you might need to do is to bring your full awareness as best you can to the fact that you're doing this. And awareness of something, awareness of a habit of the mind, tends to, with time, help that healing process to occur. But many of us are fragmented. Many of us are divided. And the function of meditation is to bring us together to be whole again. Many meditation traditions talk about the unifying effects of meditation. It unifies all the divided aspects of the psyche and the body. So with time, I think you'll find yourself relaxing from that. But you might also look at your daily life and see, is it really worth multitasking this way? You might actually be much better off. You might feel much more peaceful and happier if when you do something, you just fully give yourself to that one thing. Even though maybe you seem less efficient in terms of getting things done, it might be much more efficient in terms of becoming a happier person. When I was in a monastery in Japan, I went to talk to the cook one day, and he was chopping vegetables. And I asked him a question, and he put his knife down, stood there, and answered me. Backed off, picked up his knife, started chopping again. I continued the conversation. He was going to respond. He put down the knife, stood there and talked to me, stopped, picked up his knife, and started chopping again. And the third time I talked to him, he said, "It's very nice to talk with you. And however, I'm in the kitchen right now, and I'm supposed to be, my practice is to be fully present for my chopping the vegetables when I chop vegetables. And I don't want to do two things at once. So, and if I talk to you, then I can't do my vegetable chopping. So what is it going to be?" And I wanted the monastery to eat dinner, so I backed off and talked to him later. There's a lot of joy in life when you start doing one thing at a time. And even if it's something you don't like doing, maybe at work or something, you can find a lot of joy by not having resistance to it and just putting yourself fully and just have yourself unified around that one thing. So one of the ways that mindfulness in daily life can work is that it can help us to let go of all the ways in which we multitask and then help us to really be present fully. It doesn't take a lot of attention to become a mystic. And mystic means many things, but one of the things of a mystic is to feel awe at the glory of something as simple as the corner of an envelope. Or feel the marvel of a Xerox machine that staples. You know, there's so much you know what a mystic is someone who's able to enter the present moment enough to see the glory, the delight of you know, what's happening right now. And if you're multitasking, then you can't do that. It's hard to do that. I got a fortune cookie yesterday. I was looking for. I don't think I have it anymore. It said something like, you have the ability to appreciate the beauty of simple things. Don't lose that ability. I like that fortune cookie. I saw this hand over here. Yes.
I don't know if I can articulate this exactly, but I try to meditate first thing in the morning. And I think a lot of us wake up in the morning, and no matter what we try to do, we're revving our engines for the day that's coming up.
Yeah.
And so there's an anticipatory feeling about getting to all this stuff and all that, which is part of the present. But its origin is in the future. And so I try to shut it off because I say, be present, because that's then and is now. But it's also part of...
It makes good sense. So what we do in mindfulness practice then is the future event that you're planning for doesn't exist right now.
Exactly.
So we let go of the story the best we can. But or actually, I'll talk about this next week when we talk about thoughts. But let me back off a little bit. So if you're anxious about the day and planning the day, rather than coming back to the breath, what you do is you come back to the fact that you're anxious, and you be present for the anxiety, or you be present for the planning mind, but you're aware that in the present moment you're planning for the future. That in the present what's happening is planning. What's happening in the present is this impulse to get revved up. And that's all you need to do, because that is what's happening in the present moment.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I don't have to write a big story about what I'm going to do next or anything. It's the fact that I'm feeling kind of pumped or whatever about it.
Right. So the opportunity there is then, okay, I'll go back and feel being pumped. And what does that feel like? And you feel the upwelling energy, the pressure of that. Okay, I'm going to hang out with that pressure for a while. That's what's happening. I'm going to hang out with the pressure. And you feel this pressure. Well, that's interesting, you know. And then probably what will happen is you start feeling it like that. It'll probably begin dissipating.
So I've always felt like that was kind of self-defeating in a way, but in a way, shutting it down and ignoring it is to not be with the present. So
right.
That's what you said.
Right, right. So what some people try to do is to bypass what's happening and go right back to the breath. And so this is not... I mean, sometimes we often come in... That's often when we do meditation, is come back to the breath. But you want to be a little bit careful. If something else is predominant, something else is really what's the main thing going on, you don't want to bypass that to go back to something which is more spiritual. You know, that's the thing we pay attention to, the breath. I mean, that's the emotion, if that's what's up, or physical sensation, if that's what's up. Yes?
I'm fairly good at noticing the triggers and what the triggers mean, but I don't seem to know how to stop feeding the emotions, and they return. Is there any trick for that, or knowing how or why one keeps feeding an emotion? So that returns to these various
triggers, whatever the trigger might be. Uh-huh. So what you said was that you're very good at seeing what the triggers are, but then...
I usually can say, that's why... I had that thought, and
that's
what's causing this feeling. But why in my everyday life am I somehow, how am I feeding those emotions so that they still come up again? Not to any specific event, but just in general.
Oh, because they keep reappearing.
Yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't worry about that. I want to be respectful here, but maybe it's okay to let the emotions come up repeatedly. As we become more familiar with them, if there's a regular pattern in the emotions, then even though you might see the surface trigger, there might be some deeper underlying trigger which you haven't seen yet. And so so you might kind of look kind of underneath the surface a little bit. Are there any other emotions that are present that are kind of in the cracks between the surface emotion? So sometimes we do a little bit of investigation, look in the cracks, look more subtly and see what's going on. Sometimes looking at your relationship to the emotion that has arisen is an important way of discovering how we're feeding it. Because sometimes there's an emotion that's happening, so we bring our attention to that, but we don't notice that while the emotion's there, we have this very complicated relationship to its presence. And that complicated relationships of desire or holding on to it or justifying it or identifying with it or resisting it or hating it or whatever is operating. So sometimes you can ask the question, how am I relating to the presence of this emotion? It can be very liberating. So one more, and then we'll sit again. Yes?
If I'm experiencing an emotion and observing that and all that kind of thing, then that's kind of okay. I mean, you know, you're letting the wave come and go and break and all that kind of stuff. But if you're interacting with somebody else, who's having a wave come by and break and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I'm doing it with myself, it's a lot easier because I can sit there and observe and not really say very much except for observing it. But if you're doing that with somebody else, you know, you're just sitting there and listening to it and ideally not necessarily react to it. But then that's kind of rude. Or some people perceive that you just sit there and go,
Oh, yeah. Well, there are times when it's very helpful not to. It's really depending on what your emotions are, and what else you're doing. I mean, if you find yourself getting angry at someone, and you have the ability of not getting involved in that anger, and just letting it move through you and pass through you, pass out, then if you then stay kind of a blank screen for that person and just kind of stay still and quiet, that's rude. I mean, you have to have a human connection with someone. So you want to listen and nod and agree and ask them a question and follow through and all that. So you don't want to just be kind of, you know, a blank. But it can be very helpful to have the ability not to buy in or not to get involved with their emotions. It gives us a lot of choice about how we do want to relate to someone else. I remember once someone got really angry with me, and so I sat down with her, and she started berating me with great fury. And after a while, I realized that she'd been talking for quite a while to me, without me having said anything. And so I thought, this is really—I wonder how long I can sit here without having to say anything. Which wasn't the main purpose. My main purpose was, let me just be present for her in her anger. I was kind of in awe, amazed that someone could keep talking without any words coming from me. It was a monologue. But I had the ability of just sitting there, and every once in a while I'd watch myself get irritated or something, or watch my impatience, and I would just watch it and not buy into it, let it kind of wash through me, and, you know, and I'd go on to the next moment and be present. And it was like her anger just kind of, you know, didn't stick anywhere. If I started taking it a little bit personally, then I noticed that and didn't get involved with that, and that kind of passed away. And I just nodded and was waiting for my turn. And, you know, was very attentive, waiting for my turn. And finally there was a signal from someplace else, and I said, well, oh, you know, it's time for me to go now, excuse me. And the next day she came to me and she said, that was so helpful. She said, everyone else has always been afraid of my anger. And you weren't afraid. So I don't know if that responds to your thing. Try again.
In that case, though, you were literally saved by the bell.
This lasted at least an hour.
Right.
I mean, it was amazing amount of time. What?
Suppose the same thing happens to the same person.
And there was no bell. Oh, then I would have, you know, at some point I would have said, you know, excuse me, or I would have stopped. I'm not going to sit there, you know, until I wither away. It was just convenient to have the bell go, but you know, I would have done something on my own. You know, there was another time I got furious with the chairman of my department, and I was a graduate student. I wasn't the person you normally want to be angry with. And I was just fuming. And I didn't know quite what to do with myself. And in that situation, what my mindfulness practice helped me to do was to go to his office and explain to him what I was feeling without being accusatory. And, you know, I was kind of shaking when I was talking to him. It was quite obvious to him I was angry. But I wasn't accusatory. It was like I made I statements, right? And so the mindfulness practice really helped me because I could watch, in that case, I could watch my language and how I spoke. So that I was really speaking about my direct experience was, as opposed to an accusation, which is not my direct experience. And so in that situation, it was, you know, there was a lot of strength in our exchange. But because I wasn't accusatory, the conversation went quite well. So, I mean, it's a big subject, what you're bringing up. So, I'll say this, and then we'll meditate, that how are we going to live our lives, how are we going to live our emotional life or interpersonal lives, is a huge topic that takes years and years of life experience and mindfulness to learn how to do well. However, one of the things that meditation provides and why it's going to be so radically important is it's the one place in our life where we know that it's okay not to react. It's okay to leave things alone. We can come back to zero. And with everything else in daily life, it's not always so clear that you can do nothing. That you have to say something, you have to respond, you have to act or do something. And so it's not always so clear that here you don't have to do anything. So you have one place in life where you know that you can let whatever your experience be without acting on it. And you can learn how to come to a completely non-reactive space, a zero point. And once you've found the zero point in meditation, that becomes a very important reference for how you go about your daily life. You can see your daily life in a much clearer way. You know what's possible. So. So it's possible to begin immediately just to notice what's happening for you right now. There's no need to get to some calm place or try to make something happen. Just allow yourself to be as you are. But as you allow it, be aware of what that is. And then as a way of helping to anchor yourself in the present, to develop your capacity of presence, you can begin connecting to your breathing. And we do give some preference to our breath, a little bit, hanging in there with the breath, giving it some priority. Sometimes in the beginning of a meditation session, it's helpful for each exhalation to let go of your thoughts and concerns, soften your mind. And then as you inhale, let the inhalation kind of fill whatever quiet or empty space that's been created by letting go of your thoughts. The next time you exhale, let go again. And then just very quietly and calmly, staying with the breath, hanging in there for a series of breaths in a row, like there's a rhythm, the alternating breathing in and out. What is it that needs to be accepted right now so you can be more fully present? So there are handouts for today on the chair somewhere over there. And if you didn't get handouts for the first 2 weeks, there are extra handouts from those weeks out in the hallway. And as we had in the last 2 weeks, we have a senior student of our sitting group, a kind of seasoned practitioner, who will be available from 8:30 to 9 or so in the library. If anybody would like to talk to some seasoned practitioner, either ask about their meditation practice or ask anything they have questions about our group here or whatever seems appropriate. And that'll be Terry Lesser, who's sitting there. And she'll meet you in the library if you'd like to talk to her. So thank you all, and I wish you a happy week, and see you next week.